of this session. Our first is Patrick Thompson, who is a PhD candidate in Andy Gonzalez's lab in the Department of Biology, where he is an NSERC postgraduate fellow. He's been using lake and pond communities as his model systems lately, and his doctoral research examines how species dispersal and ecosystem connectivity affect the stability, functioning, and composition of communities in changing environments. Patrick.
Thanks, everyone, for being here. Yeah, as Tony mentioned, most of my research involves aquatic communities. Today, I'm going to be moving away from that a little bit and focusing on a more theoretical system, asking a little bit about multi-species range shifts. So as a result of climate change, we're already witnessing the distribution or ranges of many species shifting to cooler conditions, moving upwards in elevation, upwards in latitude, as they deal with these warming conditions. But they're doing so in landscapes that are increasingly fragmented. And landscape fragmentation is thought to restrict the movement of organisms across these landscapes, making it harder for them to track these changes. Therefore, the combined effect of these two anthropogenic stresses is that the future distribution and ranges of species are made fairly unpredictable. But these are the sorts of questions we want to ask as ecologists. We want to know where species are going to be in future climates and what those communities will look like. One approach that we generally use for predicting where species will be is known as the bioclimatic envelope model. Basically, we take the current distribution of species, relate that to the climates where it is it's present, and use that to make a prediction about where that species will be in the future. So, for example, here we have the current distribution of forest ecosystem types in British Columbia. And they've used that to predict where those forest ecosystem types will be under climates that they expect in 2070 to 2100. This is obviously a very useful approach because it gives us these beautiful looking maps that tell us where we can expect species to be, what those communities will look like. But the question remains, how often are these types of predictions going to be right? And that's a question I'm interested in talking about today. So the reason why these predictions might not be right is that future ranges are not only determined by climate. Species also have to be able to disperse fast enough to keep up with changes in climate. And so this is where changes in habitat fragmentation are going to affect the ability for species to track ranges. Or, as Tony was talking about, the fact that humans are moving species around in the landscape at faster rates will also affect this. Finally, habitats already contain communities, and this will affect the ability for species to colonize because of biotic interactions. Things like predator-prey dynamics or competition will affect the ability of a species to move into a new habitat. So this begs the question, how do competition and dispersal interact to mediate the predictability of multi-species range shifts? Now, when we're talking about the predictability of range shifts, we can ask a couple things. We can ask how accurate our predictions will be and how precise they will be. So, for example, we have this predicted range. This is where we think a species might be in the future. And if we were able to compare that to where it actually ends up, this green realized range, we can see that in this case, we don't have complete overlap. And so we can quantify this overlap. We can ask about how accurate is this prediction, which is how much of our realized range was predicted. So in this case, about half of that realized range falls within our predicted range, and so we have an accuracy of 50%. We might also ask about the precision. So how much of this predicted range actually ended up being realized? So you can see that about one-third of this predicted range is filled with this green realized range, and so we have 30% precision. Contrast that with a case where we have 100% accuracy, so the entire predicted range, or the entire realized range falls within our prediction, but we also predicted it to be elsewhere where it wasn't realized to be. And so we don't have a completely precise prediction, even though it's accurate. So obviously, it would be great to compare the real range shifts with our predictions, but that would involve forecasting into the future. Instead of doing that, what I've done is to use a multi-species range shift model. So imagine a landscape with 100 patches spanning a gradient from warm to cool. This is, for example, moving up in elevation on a mountain or moving up in latitude on a continent. in this range, we have 100 patches and 40 species that can live within them. And we want to ask, what is the abundance of each species in each patch? This is determined by a few things. First of all, the climate tolerance, which determines where on that landscape the species can persist. That's represented by these normal distributions here. So each species is only able to persist in part of the landscape. It's also determined by competition. So all the other species that are in each patch will affect the abundance of the focal species. And finally, by dispersal. So individuals of a species will move according to this dispersal kernel, where from a focal patch here, most individuals will disperse to nearby patches, and a few will disperse further away. A key component of this dispersal is D, the proportion of the population that disperses. So for example, we can have D of 0.5, or we can have D of 0.1. And this basically means with 0.5, half the population is dispersing at every time step. With 0.1, 10% is dispersing with each time step. In both cases, the shape of the dispersal kernel is the same, but the number of organisms that are moving differs. In this model, I'm interested in asking, how does variation in D, if we change how many organisms are moving, how does that affect the accuracy and precision in our ability to predict range shifts, as well as how does the inclusion of competition in our model affect accuracy and precision? So I'll just start out and show you how this model works. Here we have a case without warming and without competition or dispersal. So we have our 100 patches going that warm to cold gradient, and we have the abundance of each of our 40 species. I've arranged these species so that we have the ones that like the cold conditions here and the warm conditions here. And what you'll notice is that without competition and dispersal, these ranges are determined entirely by their climate tolerances in a very predictable way. We can ask where a certain species is. So here we have species 20. It's present in the middle of this gradient of patches. And we can ask which species are in a given patch. We can then compare that with what happens when we bring in competition. So what you'll notice is that interspecific competition restricts these realized distributions. So once again, going back to species 20, you can see that it's present in less of the landscape and its abundances are lower. Contrasting that with species 21, with competition, it's excluded entirely from the landscape, even though it would be able to do just fine just based on its abiotic preferences. I'll just note that this competition result is just one instance of the model. Each time we run it, we take a new random competition matrix. And so that brings in variability in our model, and you'll see that later. We can then bring in the idea of dispersal. So in the top, we have the low dispersal case I just showed you. In the bottom, we have a case with high dispersal. So first of all, you'll notice that dispersal stretches out these ranges. And the second thing that it does is it can mediate extinctions. So at low dispersal, we have cases where these species are able to persist, but at high dispersal, they've gone extinct completely. And so there's an interaction between dispersal and species interactions. Now, as I mentioned, everything I've shown up until now doesn't involve any warming, but this is a climate change model, and so we want to warm these systems up. So we start out, and we allow these communities to go to equilibrium, and then we start to warm them up at an equal rate in all patches. And after a certain amount of warming, we allow them to stabilize. And we ask what this final community looked like based on our predictions from the initial community. The key thing here is that the initial temperatures in the 50 warmest patches are actually the same as the final temperatures in the 50 coolest patches. And so we can use these to make predictions about what those communities will look like. That's illustrated here, where in the top row we have the ambient conditions or the pre-warmed conditions, and the bottom we have the warmed conditions. So basically what we've done is we've taken this initial community from the 50 warmest patches and we've projected it onto the 50 coolest patches after warming has occurred. These black lines represent our predictions of where we think the species should be based on this initial condition. We can then compare this with where they actually end up. And you can see that especially when we have competition, in many cases, our realized range doesn't quite match up with our predictions. You'll also notice that we have cases where we're unable to make predictions. These are cases where we don't have an analog condition from the initial temperatures, and so we exclude these from consideration. So all the results I'm showing today are just based on these 50 patches that we can make predictions on from our initial conditions. And so here are a couple of initial results. First, we have a case with no interactions compared when we bring in interactions. Then we have three different dispersal rates, a low, an intermediate dispersal, and a high dispersal case. And what you can see is that at low dispersal, there are many cases where our realized distribution doesn't match up with our predicted distribution. There are species that aren't there, and they aren't in the same locations. And we see the same thing occurring at very high dispersal rates. But at intermediate dispersal rates, we get quite a good match between our predictions and our realized distributions. So I'd just like to show this a little bit more formally, focusing just on the result of precision. So if you remember, precision is the idea that we have our predicted ranges, and if we have a very precise prediction, our entire predicted ranges will be filled. If we have an imprecise prediction, not the entire predicted range will be filled. So for example, in this one iteration here, we predicted these species would be present in these areas, but they're not. And so that represents an imprecise imprecise prediction at these low dispersal rates, which corresponds to this on this graph here. So if we relate precision to dispersal, we have the two cases. First of all, in black, we have the case with no interactions, and in gray, we have the case with interactions. Each of these dots represents a new random dispersal interaction matrix. Sorry, not a dispersal matrix, but an interaction matrix, which gives us variability. But the average is shown in this line. The first thing I'll point out is the effect of adding in interactions. So we see a decrease in our precision when we add species interactions. To me, this really demonstrates the need for us to be considering species interactions when we're making our predictions about where future communities will be. Obviously, that's a very difficult thing. Some people have alluded to that. But we at least need to be cognizant of the fact that species interactions are making range shifts unpredictable. But probably more interesting than that, at least from my perspective, is the effect of dispersal. So you can see in both the case with no interactions and with interactions, we get our highest precision at intermediate dispersal rates. We see an order of magnitude difference between the dispersal rate that's required to give us the highest precision when we have no interactions versus when we have interactions. So we need more dispersal when we have interactions. But what's really interesting is that going from these very low dispersal cases where we have almost no precision, so that's the case where we might have habitat fragmentation restricting movement, or we have these very high dispersal cases where we have low precision. So that's, as Tony was talking about, when we're possibly moving organisms at high rates around the landscape. But compared to those, at intermediate dispersal rates, when species are able to track the environment, we get fairly high precision, upwards of 60% on average, and in our best cases, 80% precision. So just by altering how connected the landscape is, we can really do a lot to get precise predictions. And this is key, because as I mentioned, we're probably unlikely to ever really be able to predict all species interactions. It's just too complicated to understand this, especially in communities where species are present with species they've never been present with in the past. And so just by having a connected world, we can go a long way in making good predictions about what future communities will look like and where species will be. So I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I can take some questions if there's time.
One quick question.
Thanks, Patrick. I was just wondering, it seems that your work assumes static environmental tolerances through time. And I wondered if that's a realistic assumption, especially given a landscape with low connectivity is generally urbanized.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, it's a model, and I make a lot of simplifying assumptions. And I think what's critical is that we get this main result, and now I'm taking the next step, and I'm trying to alter some of those assumptions, break them down, and ask whether or not this result still holds. I've done it a bit, especially for dispersal, because I have that assumption that all species disperse at the same rate or the same numbers. And I'm seeing that this result is fairly robust to that. I haven't yet broken down the assumption that you referred to, but that's the next step that I need to explore.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tony.
All right.